So we have been following the story of the Exodus for a while now. And it sort of seems like we should see the people across the sea. So I want to spend some time with that story this morning, this story of the Red Sea. And also, maybe even more, I'd like to talk about stories themselves. And so we're going to go to the beginning again. Jochebed gave birth at the worst time. The mother of Moses gave birth at the worst time. Because the baby was a boy, and because Pharaoh had decreed that the boys would be thrown into the river, she hid him. She hid him probably for as long as most Hebrew mothers tried to hide their babies until the inevitable. And what she did then was desperate. And what she did is a little hard to understand, because she decided to take him right to the place of dread. She decided to take him right down into the Nile that was swallowing up the boy children of her people. She takes him right down to the Nile. And she makes a place for him in the water. She took a basket made out of papyrus leaves. She covered it with resin, pitch, to keep the water out. She made a little teva for him. That's the word. She made a little teva for him. She made a teva for him, another teva for him. Another teva for the people, like the teva that Noah made, that he made and covered in pitch for his family and all the creatures of the earth to survive afloat on the floodwaters. She made an ark for the baby. And she set the ark down in the reeds. Set him down in the suf. That's the word. She set him down in the suf, and she left. And the baby sister waited to see what would be done to him. But his mother left, because she'd done what she could do. And now the baby was adrift. And today, the people are pressed up against another water, against the Yam Suf, that same word, the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. See, that's how this way of telling works. That's how this way of telling stories works. It's always running and reaching forward and backward, so that when we tell the story of this desperate mother at the riverside, there are hooks that help us to remember God guiding the ark to the ground again, to help us remember that God swore faithfulness, that water would never swallow creation again. And we glimpse the deliverance yet to come in the story. The reeds will be in again, when God will act. And we're invited to expect the deliverance we can't even imagine yet. So, finally broken by the Passover of the Lord, Egypt has sent Israel out from among them. They even carried the bones of their ancestor Joseph with them, so that the whole house of Joseph's father went into the wilderness together, one whole people, following the Lord, who poured his presence down in a pillar of cloud. Men, women, and children. And when they came to a place called Pi-Hahiroth, the Lord said to make camp with their backs to the sea. And there, all the captains and chariots of Egypt, the picked army of Pharaoh, overtook them again. And that is where it looked like they were going to have to fight it out. And that's where it looked like the end would be. But Moses, remember Moses, whose name means that he was drawn out of the water? Moses knew something was going to happen. And he begged them to just be still. Because the fight, whatever happened, would be the Lord's, the way it had been all along. We have the psalm today, too. The psalm we said together. And the psalmist sings these lines. They sing that when Israel came out of Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of strange speech, Judah became God's sanctuary and Israel his dominion. The sea beheld it and fled. Jordan turned and went back. They begin at that moment in Israel's story, the moment we've been building towards, Israel on its journey out of Egypt. But the poet has an eye that sweeps outward to gather a much longer story into that moment. So remember, the Reed Sea didn't part in the psalm. The sea didn't part. The sea fled. The sea flees, the way the psalmist sees it. The Jordan turned its back. We aren't there yet, right? We can't see the Jordan from where we stand. But for the psalmist, we're there already. When Israel came out of Egypt, they sing, the Judah became God's sanctuary. Where's Judah? We're singing about a nation not yet to be, a nation far over any horizon of the people there by the sea. The wilderness, Sinai, the presence in the journeying Ark of the Covenant, the Jordan, Canaan, kings, a holy city, the hill of Zion, where the Lord made a home, a sanctuary in the darkness of the temple. It's all somehow present already as the people stood there on the shore, wondering what was about to happen next. So even in their very first few lines, the very first few lines of the psalm, the poet has already gone back to the beginning and transformed the meaning of its first line. Because Israel's coming out of Egypt, cannot be just a passage in history, a moment, a thing that happened, an event with a beginning and an end. It's always. Israel is always coming out of Egypt. It will always be coming out of Egypt. Something else is happening here too. In the Exodus telling of the escape across the sea, the Egyptians are this crucial antagonist. The story doesn't make sense without Egyptians in it, right? The story's driven by their spear points, by our sense of like the wheels of the chariots turning down onto the people. And at the end of the Exodus story, at the end of the Red Sea crossing, it's the bodies of the Egyptians that are proof of the victory. But in the psalm, the Egyptians are just a setting. They're just a people of strange speech. They're just a place left behind. And there's no Moses. There's no outstretched hand. There's no human action at all. There's not even driving wind from God. There's not a path through the water. Here, the actor is the sea itself. The sea that saw the Lord with Israel and ran away. What's that about? What are these mountains, these skipping mountains, about? Mountains are nowhere in the delta landscape that the people crossed out of Egypt. And they're nowhere in the crossing story either. But they're here in the psalm. And the psalmist may well be reaching into a whole different part of the Exodus story later, when the Lord, who'd promised Moses that the people would meet him in fire at the mountain, comes down onto the mountain, and the mountain shook and smoked. But in the psalm, there's no story. There's just the memory of the earthquake and the shaking mountain. But imagined like rams, like leaping, dancing rams, like lambs of the flock at play, shaking out in the field, dancing as they receive the presence of God on the earth. So this is like a memory that's being sung into a deeper truth about what happened. Right now, somewhere in the East Delta of Egypt, there may be a brick. I don't know. There may be a brick with the thumbprint of a Hebrew slave in it. Maybe. Or not. And maybe 1,000 floods of the river have blurred every trace of them to silt, like the dust that was the bones that they carried out of Egypt. But the past, what we call the past, the sequence of events between there and here, the past really exists in the present. That's where it is. It's not back there, it's here. The past exists in the present because that's where sense gets made of what happened. That's where memory is made meaningful as story. That's where what happened become something that we live and die by. And our own pasts have that kind of life too. Our own pasts are a thing we hold in the present. And if we listen to the stories we've received, if we listen to these scriptural stories we receive, we hear in their recitation of events, in their poetry, we hear over and over the meaning of the story. They're reaching and striving to give us the meaning of the story, why it matters, why we tell this to each other again and again and again. Why I'm telling this to you now. They're desperate to tell us that God fills the earth, that the earth is enervated and inflamed, that the earth is set alight by God's nearness to it. We hear that God made a way for Noah and a way for Moses and a way for Israel across the sea because the Lord is faithful to creation. And the stories all and always point backwards and forwards. They reach backwards and they point forwards. They hold the whole thing at once, each one. They even hold the unknown future. Beyond the papyrus of the Nile, beyond the Jordan, beyond the rise and fall of kingdoms, beyond exile and return, they hold it all, even what we don't know. And our stories are like that too. Our stories can hold the reality of our lives in a world that's at risk, where we are always at risk. Our stories can hold the next wilderness, the next abandonment, the next sickness, the next uprooting. They can hold the next loss. The one whose shape we don't know, but we know is out there, that we know is coming. It can hold that too, because we know the shape of the bigger story. We know that it's shaped like suffering and the redemption of that suffering. It's shaped like falling into captivity and being led to freedom again. It's shaped like death and resurrection, and death and resurrection, and death and resurrection. All our deaths, all the losses that are the story of our life, and all the resurrections that have brought us here. It holds all of that at once. God making a way and calling us into it again and again and again. And as much as anything we have, that might be the thing that matters most that we can give away. We can give away our daring to tell our story like that. Our daring to risk calling our losses death and our hope resurrection. We can risk what the psalmist is risking here. Not just telling our story, but saying what it means about us and the God who holds us and has never abandoned us and never will. Amen.